Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, so much for tuning in. This is part two of our exploration of a little-known astronaut program back in the 1600s. Yes, that entire sentence sounds bananas, but we assure you it is factual. Please listen to the first part of this series before you proceed on to episode two. I think that's all our housekeeping, Noel. You're Noel.
I am Noel, and you are Ben, and if I may be so bold, I think we're ready to dive on in.
In his defense, in defense of this nascent space program, we should point out astronomers of this time, like around 1640 or so, they knew how far away the moon was, right?
They did. They knew it pretty accurately by today's standards. So they could kind of plot out what this trip might look like if they, you know, made it a little more routine. It would probably take several weeks. And this made sense to them at the time because they were used to those kinds of really long, arduous treks because of ocean voyages.
Mm-hmm. And there's also a tinge of capitalism here, not a small tinge by any means, because Wilkins is thinking, okay, assuming all this works, there are a lot of ifs in Wilkins' reasoning here, but John's thinking, okay, if this works, will we meet inhabitants on the moon? You'll see, if you read his stuff, you'll see that he called them Selenites, based on the name, the Greek moon goddess Selene. And he was like, okay, if we meet these people on the moon, hey, we might be able to sell them stuff. We could establish a moon trade. A moon trade.
I love it. In this History Extra article that we've been digging into, they refer to this as a, quote, lucrative celestial market.
Right, exactly. I love that that was probably part of the pitch. You know, he's telling aristocrats and royalty about how we could do this. And then there's more moment, you know?
I mean, it's very charming, especially when you read it now, but it's sort of the same thing we talk about when we're like, okay, if there was like the singularity or like, you know, beings from another dimension or another, you know, planet far, far, far away from us came, we would have no reference for communication. We would have no shared anything, you know, or we couldn't possibly assume that we would. I guess maybe the moon's close enough that they could be receiving our, you know, nowadays, you know, television transmissions, like in that episode of Pete and Pete about Johnny Unitas. Remember that one? Classic episode. But yeah, this is a very, again, geocentric kind of view of the world. These merchants would be so full of themselves that they believed that they would have anything to offer moon people.
Right, right. You know, moon people would have contacted us if they wanted something, surely. Also, let's get in front of the bad, very dark humor here. This is before the opium trade is really blossoming. If this had occurred a little bit later, 18th, 19th centuries, then I'm sure that Wilkins would have said, and we can sell the moon people opium, because that was very much a British push for a time. Anyway, his ideas had a few beautiful things about them. They're optimistic, yes. They're plausible, yes. He's taking the knowledge of space, gravity, human biology, all the stuff that's available at the time. He is making a good faith effort to do due diligence. Also, I said doo-doo. He was also super open-minded, which I think is a point you raised earlier in the episode, Noel. Like he wanted the truth. He wanted the correct answers. His ego was not taking precedent over facts. Like if someone else said, well, hey, John, you know, I like what you're saying about blah, 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 but what about this idea? Then he would hear them out. He was very much crowdsourcing this, and he had a different take on different things at different times as new information came in and was available. Like originally, I believe someone asked him how these astronauts would eat while they're in space, right? It's not like they can go hunting. It's probably not a good look to shoot moon people if you land. And he had an interesting pitch. It's something I didn't think of. I know how weird this sounds today, but he said, well, we have to understand these space travelers are not going to be subject to gravity at this point. So, quote, we shall not at all spend ourselves in any labor and consequently not much need the reparation of diet, but may perhaps live altogether without it. So he's like, you're floating, you're not working against gravity, you don't have to eat. This would also prove to be incorrect. Shout out to dehydrated ice cream and space food.
You know, in Deadwood, how they often refer to the Chinese as celestials, like mm-hmm. like a racial slur. Mm-hmm. What do you think it has anything to do with this idea of moon, of like aliens, or them like, you know, co-opting that term for spacemen and just, you know, talking about like these weird Chinese people that might as well be from another planet and calling them celestials?
Yeah, it comes from an old name that was used to refer to China as the Celestial Empire, it was sometimes called, which is a translation of an older name for the region and the country, which I believe is Tianqiao.
Interesting. Okay, that makes sense. But still, you know, even referring to it as the Celestial Empire implied some level of othering, of almost like putting them in the same boat as, say, people from another planet.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a good point. This is coming from the perspective of, can we extend an empire here? He found this story of a German person who apparently slept throughout the entire winter, hibernating, essentially. And new research in our modern day proves that there is a possibility to create the circumstances for human hibernation. But he also, you know, again, I can't emphasize this enough. He's working with the information he has at the time. And he says, look, there are reports that I believe prove human beings can indeed hibernate the way mammals like bears do. And so maybe they can just sleep, right? Sleep the moon voyage away and not have to eat and not have to breathe, etc. He did say, he did put a little caveat in there, a little olive branch to the haters. And he said, if none of these ideas convince you, there may happily be some possible means for the conveyance of other food. And he's like, all right, if you guys are going to be divas about it, I guess we can pack some lunches, is how I took it. So it's kind of nuts that Wilkins is making all this progress. And it is progress. This ideation is solid. It's nuts that he's able to do it, especially given the widespread turmoil in England at the time. Again, in 1642, the English Civil War began. It led to the abolition of the Anglican Church. The king was beheaded. Oliver Cromwell became Lord Protector as a result of these events. And that's when Wilkins marries Robina, Oliver Cromwell's younger sister, and he becomes the brother-in-law of Cromwell, who is at this time, you know, who is at a time, or for a time, he has temporarily removed the royal family from power.
And I think in my mind, I just think of him as being a very heavy-handed ruler who was also a bit of a zealot. Isn't that right?
Well, he definitely had a reputation, as we said, as an intense dude, a harsh ruler. He was, to your point, a religious hardliner. He does have a real legacy, though. A fun, weird fact. There are more roads named after Cromwell than any other British ruler other than Queen Victoria. It's like I'm sure there are like Cromwell Lanes, Cromwell Street, that's an easy one. British listeners, please let us know how Cromwell's legacy affects your neck of the global woods. Here's the thing. This is why I keep bringing up League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, or maybe Ozymandias and his explorations in The Watchmen, the HBO series. No spoilers. It's cool. Check it out. When he is warden of Wadham College Oxford between 1648 and just before 1660. Wilkins gets his crew together. He assembles a club of scientific friends. And like, it's kind of like a salon. It's kind of like a think tank. You know, if they were getting together in a different time, they might have made a podcast. I don't know. I love that approach where he's like, fellow well-to-do intellectuals, come, we shall sup on moist sponge and speculate on the exploration of the mean.
It's just for comfort, Ben. It's just a sponge your way to comfort. I don't quite understand how that works. Just to like wet the nape of your neck or something to keep
maybe
you from
wet
drying
your whistle
out
a little.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. It's kind of, are you suck on the sponge? I'm confused about the implementation of the sponge.
So why are we mentioning the idea of Wilkins pitching stuff? Well, it's because it turns out that he kind of was. Like, if you look at his books, you might agree with a science historian named Dr. Alan Chapman, who says that his earlier works especially read kind of like a proposal to investors. Like, hey, get in on the ground floor and then go 20 miles up with me to the moon, aka help me pay for materials and help me with the research. The interesting thing is, and one thing I love that you pointed out, Noel, that this wasn't all just pen and paper brainstorming. The interesting thing here is that some of this stuff made it to the experimentation phase. He had, and I love this, talk about goals for a house. He had an inventor's garden of all these cool gadgets and devices at the college when he was warden. And they held things like, here's the kind of stuff he had in this garden: a talking statue, something called a rainbow maker, which I imagine is a prism, right? That sounds right.
That's so funny you say that. My girlfriend is a stained glass artist, and one of her most popular items that she makes is something she calls a rainbow maker. And it's a glass kind of frame with a prism crystal hung in the middle. And I actually have one on my window, and it's the most lovely way to wake up in the morning with the morning sun streaming through and kind of splitting up into little like dancing rainbows all over the room. But yeah, she literally calls them rainbow makers.
That's so wholesome, man. Yeah, I bet that is. I bet that is amazing, especially depending on where your window is placed.
And check out her work at Daylight Glassworks on Instagram. Plug, if that's okay.
Ooh, this guy's going for the boyfriend points. Yeah, let's do it. I got your back.
All right, cool.
What was it again? I'll say it too.
Daylight Glassworks.
Daylight Glassworks. You heard it here first. Do check it out.
Custom jobs, whatever you want. You want it in stained glass? She's got you covered.
And there are other inventions here. One that is very clever and I think is still fascinating to a lot of people today is a glass beehive so that you could see what goes on within the hive. That's so cool. So his buddy we mentioned earlier, Robert Hooke, another natural philosopher, was also writing about experimenting with flying machines in the garden with John Wilkins. Unfortunately, they didn't get too specific about it. Why did they not get too specific about it? Well, there are two ways to think of this, folks. We'll give you both ways, and then you can choose which you like best. First, maybe it's because these experiments were unsuccessful. All right, yeah. Secondly, maybe it worked too well. Maybe it worked so well that they were like, Cromwell can never know. We must save the world is not ready for space geese. We have to keep people on the planet. Or maybe they went to the moon. They're like, moon people are jerks. They took our moist sponges. Anyway, soon after these experiments, we know that Robert Hooke stops focusing on space exploration and gets really into clocks.
Yeah, I mean, you know, a lot, like we said, a lot of the things that the mechanics of designs like his flying chariot and other, concepts certainly hinged on the kinds of electromechanical, you know, principles that would serve a watchmaker. And so we all pretty much knew this was coming. Not too much of a surprise here. The flying chariot never really became a thing. It was not particularly destined to take wing for realsies. Science was moving ahead at such an insane clip that Wilkins was a pretty good idea, man. And this flying chariot, you know, was clever and definitely fantastical. By the time he was 50 years old, he had been left in the dust by the up-and-coming class of scientists. In 1664, he finally decided that that was just not possible. By 1659, research done by his friends Robert Boyle and Robert Hooke actually led to the discovery of the vacuum. And that led to things like the vacuum tube, which we use today in electronics, and also just understanding how things work in a vacuum and that space itself is a vacuum, an airless environment that would not be possible to inhabit without some technology that was way, way above their weight class at this time, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Their weightless class?
There it is. Yeah, whatever. There it is. So Wilkins doesn't make it to space in his corporeal form, but the charisma the guy had, the curiosity he had, really put him at the forefront of the scientific movement in England. And again, unless you're talking about space travel, nothing occurs in a vacuum. So the monarchy is restored after civil wars. 1660, Wilkins Scientific Club is chartered as the Royal Society. It is still one of, if not the most prominent and auspicious scientific body in Great Britain. Wilkins becomes Bishop of Chester in 1668, and his pal Robert Hooke becomes the greatest experimental physicist of the age. And as Wilkins continues his ongoing quest of discovery and innovation, he keeps thinking, I love you said idea man, he keeps thinking of new ideas. He's one of the people who says, why don't we make a universal language so everyone can talk to one another? Why don't we have, get this folks, a predecessor of encrypted personal messaging, which is nuts, by the way, that he even thought of this. He was like, let's make a signal cipher system so anybody can communicate their thoughts to a friend at any distance with privacy and speed. How nuts is that? How nuts is it for you to be sitting around in the mid to late 1600s and go, you know what? I need to invent text messaging. I need to invent signal. I need to invent the signal
app. Oh, totally. And we did an episode around the new year about Nikola Tesla and his pals, some of their predictions that, like you said, that is what science fiction is all about. It's about predicting what could be without maybe having the means to make it actually happen. And then so many people are inspired by these ideas, you know, like the idea of pocket communicators, you know, from Star Trek or whatever. Now that's just like everyday stuff. And we've talked about, you know, Tex Avery cartoons like, or Chuck Jones, I always forget, like Rocket by Baby, or like the, you know, the kind of pop culture, pop art depictions of the future back in the 50s. So it's just very interesting to see these kind of idea people, these thinkers like Wilkins, or, you know, even people like Robert Heinlein, like authors that then kind of postulate things that ultimately do come into being eventually.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And we buried the lead a little bit here. He coined the word cell in biology, in the discipline of biology. And so he got a lot of street cred from other natural philosophers, his pals in the club that became the Royal Society of Science. And even if we look back on everything he got wrong, what we see is a very self-aware dude. Because he was thinking in the right direction. Like I said earlier, you know, learning which questions to ask is just as important as finding answers to questions. And a lot of stuff he wanted to do actually happened just much later than he would have liked. He said something really inspiring too, when he was talking about these wild ass ideas of exploring space. He said, he pointed out, you know what, folks? We use boats and ships all the time. and the invention of ships at one time seemed impossible to the people who first conceived them. And, quote, none but the bold, daring men durst adventure. We have no just reason to be discouraged in our hopes of the like success. So he's like, we built ships on the ocean. Why can't we get ships in the moon? You know? And I think this is what inspired the guy who later took the stage name Fred Durst.
he's been making a new career for himself as a hack director.
Really? I saw him as an actor in a horror film I watched a while back, and it's tough to recognize him. So he's a director, huh?
Well, I mean, you know, you could put that in quote fingers. I'm not sure. I haven't seen his work, to be fair, but Casey, you might be aware he made a movie called, I think, The Fan or The Stalker, something like that. John Travolta's in it, and he basically plays a, let's just say, developmentally disabled fan of an actor who then goes full psycho and home invades him and tortures him and ties him to a chair. And just the clips of it that I've seen, it's like, wow, John Travolta, you really, really went for that. And Fred Durst, you really pushed him to go for that. So I can't really support that. Casey, do you know what I'm talking about?
It looked rough. Yeah, I couldn't go beyond just a few clips here and there, but it looks like a future camp classic, maybe.
Okay, well, not every Travolta joint can reach the caliber of Battlefield Earth. I mean, that's just the reality of the business. But Fred Durst aside, John Wilkins is really inspiring. You know, if we wanted to put it in perspective, we could say that they belong to a sort of honeymoon era of science. Enough stuff had been discovered, again, by Europeans, is very Eurocentric, to open up all kinds of wonderful possibilities. We knew that things we had thought were impossible were achievable. And now we just had to figure out what else we could do. And Wilkins, his likability, his genial nature, I think, stood the test of time. Because if you look in one of his books, The Discovery, it ends with him making a humble prediction where he says, you know, posterity is probably going to be surprised by how ignorant me and all my friends are today. it comes at the end of some very mistaken beliefs about the moon. He's saying, even if I'm wrong, I'm trying. And other people should try too, right? That's cool. I think that's so approachable. I kind of want to hang out with him. I do not want to hang out with his brother-in-law. Again, seems like Oliver Cromwell seems intense.
Oh, yeah. And as long as you keep the space geese safely distanced from me, I would be down to hang as well.
And with that, with our final shout out to Space Geeks, this concludes our two-part series.
Space Geeks and Geese, by the
yes.
way.
Yes. Geeks and Geese. I'll honk to that. So this concludes our two-part series on the lifetimes and dreams of John Wilkins. We hope that you enjoyed it. We hope that anybody listening to this who is maybe, you know, if you're young, you want to go to space camp, we hope you get a chance to. If you're a parent, you want to send a kid to space camp, we hope you get a chance to. If you're listening right now, and let's say, you know, you're a middle schooler or a high schooler or something, believe us, you totally can be an astronaut. I guarantee you John Wilkins would want you to. Is that off base? You think that works?
No. And not to mention the opportunities, newly available opportunities, perhaps, that we're going to see moving forward with the Space Force. I know we probably ragged on that a little bit when it first came out for reasons. But, you know, now it's actually moving forward. And it seems like there's some opportunities for some budding space enthusiasts to get involved.
And please let us know about your adventures and your endeavors. Thanks, as always, to our super producer, Casey Pegram. Thanks as well to Christopher Hasiotis and Eves Jeffcoat.
Huge thanks to Gabe Lusier, researcher extraordinaire, Jonathan Strickland, the Quister, Alex Williams, who composed our theme. And Ben, thanks to you for being a friend and always being there and protecting me from the space geese.
Back at you, Noel. Here's to the moon.
To the moon! See you next time, folks.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.